Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 11th of Elul. Thank you for joining us. Today we're going to see mostly a tshuva of the Chatam Sofer's about an epileptic chazan, and then we'll move on maybe, if we have time at the end, to think issues about which poor people we have to support, which is a very brief tshuva, and therefore it's just going to be at the end of our discussion today. So the first question came up in Shu'at Chatam Sofer, in the second Chelek in the Yerideya part, Siman Zayin, chapter 7. It is a tshuva from the 11th of Elul of Tuf Kuf Pei Chet, which he wrote as Pikeach. Living out the tough, you got the word wise, so it was a year, you know, hopefully it would be the years of Pikeach, somebody who's in their full right mind, and a year of people being in that way, that would have been 1828. Question that came to him was, there was a man who was a chazan in a certain town, he served as chazan and shochet. I actually knew a man many years ago who had that position, meaning if a community wants to bring somebody to town to be a shochet, because they don't have any shochetim nearby, and they need to make it a full-time position in some way, so you'll put a bunch of things together. So I knew a man, a very nice man, but he was the shamus in the shul, and the shochet, and the second chazan. He wasn't good enough to be the main chazan. I mean, that's what they thought in this town. And he was a chazan, and he taught bar mitzvah, right? They put it all together. You needed him, but you had to put together a bunch of functions in order for the community to be able to support him to the extent that he needed. So this man was chazan and shochet. And Rev the Chatam Sofer starts off the tshuva saying, first of all, Yichatim, right? Wishes him a good judgment, because once Elul starts, we start thinking about judgment and are aware of the upcoming judgment, are worried about the upcoming judgment. And then you know, Shilat Chacham Chatsi Tshuva, that the question itself brings up many of the important issues. That's when a Chacham, when a wise person asks a Shaila, they, in their question, put in enough to make it clear that they know what they're talking about. And this man did that as well. So you have a Shatz, he's a Chazan and a Shokait, and he's very good at his job, and he has a very nice voice. He's somewhat elderly, but he has all of the good qualities that Chazal had mentioned in terms of a Chazan. Problem is, now lifrakim nichpe, rachmana litzlan. So I think nichpe, I'm pretty sure, means he has epileptic fits, and he falls to the ground and he shakes, and it often happens in shul during shacharit, during the morning prayers. And the doctors have said that it comes from the fact that he hasn't eaten anything, that his heart is empty, and he has to eat something. And if he ate something, that would... But the problem is, if he has these kinds of attacks, it causes a terrible fright among all the people around. They're not used to it, and they're so... They call it roch lev, soft-hearted. They're so... Which sounds like a good thing, meaning you're compassionate, but it's also... They're unable to notice that this happens to people, and the man's going to be fine. He's had an attack, and that's what it is. But they have this reaction to it, the people around it, that it can bother them. Even the person writing the letter seems to have had this reaction that the whole day he's upset about it from witnessing it, even though it's a part of life. So the question is, first, can we trust this man's shchita? And the problem with the shchita is, if you didn't realize that he's having an attack, the attack might be coming and he doesn't know it yet, and then he might have ruined the shchita along the way before it became clear that he had an attack. He might also be considered a shote at the time of the attack, such that he could be considered somebody valid. Meaning, even if the ritual slaughter of the animal happened properly, if he himself is considered a shote, not in his right mind, then he cannot do a valid shkita at those moments, and therefore the shkita might be invalid. And then the question would be whether he could also be a shatz, whether he also can be chazan for the tzibur, because especially on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, because that if you call that a mum, so we'll get to the question of why we would think of it as a mum, meaning a blemish that would stop somebody from being able to be a kohen, why that's related to here, we'll talk about later on in the tshuva. But even if not that issue, it might be considered a question of hakrivehu na lepechatecha. The Navi complains about the fact that the Jews bring bad sacrifices to Hashem. So maybe putting up a man with such a clear blemish to him and a clear problem to him, maybe that should be considered not choosing the best chazan that they could, the best cantor that they could, the best representative that they could, and should therefore be considered a problem, especially if he's going to have an attack while he's standing up there as chazan. That would be, you know, an embarrassment to the community and not the way that we want to approach Hashem as a community. And maybe, even if we don't let him be a chazan, maybe we should tell him he also should daven in the same room. Because if he davened in the same room and has an attack, and all the people around are so upset, and asking the question is, and maybe minors in the room, children in the room, yistaknu, they might become endangered, meaning it'll affect them so badly, they themselves will be put into danger. I don't know what that meant in terms of the delicacy of the people at the time, but that's the way it's being presented, that you have to worry about this. So some people think all these reasons are good enough, that he has to just, unfortunately, get another job, and they think that they can't have him in either his communal functions. And then those who want to keep him, the way the Chasam Sofer, the way the question is presented, they want to keep him, Nekolo Arev, because he has a very pleasant voice, which, to me, and maybe I shouldn't editorialize, but to me is a problem a little bit, because if you're willing to ignore everything else just because he has a nice voice, so that's kind of a problem, because it means you're putting the pleasantness of the davening above everything else. But then they bring in much better reasons. The much better reason is the man is unfortunately a poor man. Many people who work in Jewish community service don't have a lot of money. He's poor and he has children who are dependent on him. And he's also a chacham, he's wise, and he's honest, and he's a good God-fearing Jew, and so you'd like to help him out. Those are obviously much better and really great reasons. Try to find a way to help this all work out. So, when the Chasam Sofer comes to the answer, he says, in terms of Shechita, he thinks it's a debate between Rashi and the Rambam. Rashi, in interpreting the Gemara about a person who has these sudden attacks, makes it sound like Rashi understands the way the Gemara does it, there's a shade. Right. So the question of the definition of shade is obviously complicated. The common way to define it is a demon. So that would, if you're going to take it literally, it'll mean you believe in demons and angelology, and the whole question of how angels and demons work would become a question for you. Rashi doesn't get into it, which is what the Chasam Sofer says. It sounds like Rashi just takes it literally. If that's what takes it literally, the tradition of the way demons work, if you're going to take them literally, is that they come suddenly. They come and they go, and it's all or nothing. That's actually better for our shochet, because if they come and go and it's all or nothing, then it means that when we see this man and he doesn't seem to be in the middle of an attack, we don't have to worry that maybe he's in the middle of an attack, or maybe he's in the early stages of an attack. If it's from 0 to 60 in terms of attack, then we'll know when he's in the middle of attack, always, and that should mean, therefore, that as long as he's not, he can perform the Shechita. So that version of it would make it better for him. But the Rambam understood, because the Rambam, you know, the more naturalist version, the more rationalist version of understanding these Gemaras wouldn't take the word shade literally. He thinks that it's a function of either he has, you know, a blood issue, too much blood, too little blood, however mental issues come up in natural ways, right? You could point to the blood, you could point to, in their times, depression was often thought of as a marash chora, a black bile. That was too much, right? If you have in the Middle Ages, still, in the time of the Rambam, they believed that keeping certain bodily fluids in balance was the key to mental health. Now, when mental health went awry, it was because one or other of the fluids was out of proportion. I once actually was in a museum of medical history, and they had a whole exhibit on which one was considered too much and what you would do to try to reduce or try to improve the balance of the liquids inside somebody. In any case, the point being, and this part of it could be relevant to modern medical views as well, is if it's a natural illness, then when we see the attack, we might think, or we probably would think, and this is the way the person presenting the question had raised it with the Reish Chatzim Sofer, who compliments him with Divrei Pi Chacham Chaim, right? When a Chacham writes and speaks, it's a pleasure, and we should kiss the lips, not literally, but we should be praised the lips that do such things, because if the attack comes, let's say, from too much of fluid, bodily fluid X, right? But when bodily fluid X gets to be a billion, that's when he has an attack. So that would mean, though, or at least imply, that when bodily fluid X is at 990,990, then you're on the way to an attack, and then already we might have to worry that there were signs of the attack already that we didn't know, or maybe he's on the way and maybe he's already qualifies as a shoteh, as somebody not in his right mind for halakhic purposes. That would mean that even if we didn't see any evidence of it, even if the knife didn't move in the wrong way in any way, but if he's a shoteh halakhically, if he qualifies as not being in his right mind, then the slaughter will be invalid. And that's why the Rambam in the Torah had mentioned the halacha that when you have issues where you need to know that a person is in their right mind, you have somebody who we know is sometimes a shoteh, sometimes not in their right mind, sometimes yes in their right mind. That would be issues for if giving a get, for example, right? Shotim can't do that. People not in their right mind can't give a get to their wives if they have to. They can't do it. It's not we don't want to do it. They can't halachically do it. So the Rambam in the Torah point out that you need the witnesses to be clear and sure not only that he's in his right mind at the time, but he's also not at the end of a right mind period or starting a period of not as right mind. You know all the symptoms of the onset of this or the offset. Maybe he'll look to us largely right, but the truth is he's just coming down off of an episode of whatever it was, and he doesn't qualify halakhically as not a shoteh yet. So that would be an issue for the shkita as well. And that explains the Gemara in Ksubot. It talks about if somebody who sometimes is not in their mind, they sell things, they have a problem with knowing whether the sale is valid or not. Because when they're not in their right mind, the sale can't be valid. And we don't know which is which. And the Rambam says, I don't understand. We have a different, we have a chazaka, we have a general assumption, halacha, that witnesses only sign if they know the person is in their right mind, because they'll check. But for the Rambam, now the Chazam Zofar says, we can understand it perfectly. Because sometimes when they check, they don't check carefully, and there could be these symptoms that show that he's on his way out of an episode or into an episode, and that would qualify him halachically as a shoteh, is not his right mind. So you have all these issues. So in terms of shkita, you have a problem. For us, you don't have a problem, because we could say it just comes and goes. It's all or nothing. It's an on-off switch. You're either in an episode or not. But for the Rambam, we seem to have a problem, because there's a more gradual process, and then maybe they're in the process one way or the other, and that would have halakhic ramifications, even though we don't immediately spot it and don't notice it unless we pay a lot of careful attention. The Chazam Zofar says he thinks that actually it's even worse than that, because he thinks even if you're going to take Rashi literally and say it's talking about the advent of a demon, he says, the Chazam Zofar, and this is an interesting thing because he's building off of the idea of demons being real, and yet he's giving it what we would call a more rationalist twist, although I don't think you would have seen it that way. He says that even in that view, they don't come and go suddenly and completely, because he says, "Ein shedim veruchim," these demons, whatever they are, and evil spirits that the Gemara sometimes talk about, they can only have any control over a person. They can only infect a person or come into a person if there's something wrong with that person, with his mind or his intellect to begin with. Now, he doesn't mean this as a rationalist version. I mean, he's not talking about the fact that really it's like the Rambam said. He means that those who believe in demons literally still think that people, when they are well-formed and when they're paying attention to the world the right way and they're involved in the world in the right way and they have their minds and they're fully in their right minds, are immune to demons. Because Hashem created the form of the human being, Shleima, he says, the form of people is, when they're whole, is immune to demons. So, and it's only when there's something wrong with them to begin with that the demons come in, and he says, I can, and the part of the proof of that is that most people, the vast majority of the people who have a mental illness, who become crazy in his version, right, and who come insane, which we might say is that they've had a demon involved in them, they do bad things, not good things, right? It's not usually true that you say somebody's crazy in a way that makes it better. Sometimes it happens, but more commonly, people who are out of their right mind damage themselves and sometimes damage others. For the Chazam Sofer, that means that it's because of something, some flaw in them already, that the demon could come in. So whether or not one believes in whichever version of those issues one wants to take, the Chazam Sofer is pointing out, when it comes to Shkita, it's not true that if a person looks whole to us, we can be positive that he's whole and okay, because it could be, either for Rashi or for the Rambam, it could be that there's a problem. That leads us to believe then that when it comes to shkita, we're going to have to be very careful with this person, even more than buying and selling things, especially about the knife, because we're going to have to be very careful the knife is okay and that he's okay. So the man who had sent the letters to Chazam Zofar said that he had an idea. He sent two shochtim always together to the slaughterhouse so that they would check each other's knives, and in doing so, they would also be aware of each other and see what was going on and see that the other person was fine. So if this shochet had somebody else watching him and looking at him and checking him, we could have reason to believe that if they're checking carefully, we can be sure that he's okay. Meaning it's not that this is completely impenetrable to our ability to see it and understand what's going on. It's just that you don't always check it out carefully. But if you're already checking the knife well, you'll know to check the other person well as well. Even more, I think, helpful is that the man pointed out that even when it came to birds, where you don't have to check the knife each time, so you're shechting fowl, the man writing the letters of the Chasam Sofer pointed out, but you don't eat the bird right away, because after the shechting is shechted, then you have to salt it, you have to soak it, then you have to cook it, and that takes time, and that takes at least a half an hour. And if they shochet, this poor man who's got this medical problem, right? And we're worried that his medical problem has a lot of ramifications for us, even if we'd prefer they wouldn't have had it. So this poor man, if he doesn't have an attack within the half hour it takes to prepare the chicken, will know that the chicken is okay because he didn't have an attack. So really our worry is, if he's in the middle of an attack, he's not going to do a shechita. Our worry is that maybe while he was doing the shechita, an attack was on its way, or he was just coming out of an attack. So just coming out of an attack, we can know, because we'll know he didn't have an attack that morning. But maybe he's on his way into an attack, and he already qualifies halachically as a shoteh, as not in his right mind, and therefore unable to perform a shechita. But since it takes time to prepare the result of a shechita, you're just going to eat it right away. But right away doesn't mean right away. It means it'll take time. You have to soak it. You have to get rid of all the blood. Then you'll have to cook it. And that takes time. So it'll give us time to know that a shechita must have been okay because he won't have had an attack. So that all seems to help greatly in letting him to continue to be the shochet, especially since, as Rechaz Mosofer points out, that would be true if we have no idea of when these attacks come. Right? If these attacks appear with no rhyme or rhythm or regularity, so we have a problem. It's called having a veset. If they have no veset to them, if they have no regularity to them, these ideas would be helpful already. But in our case, it's even more so because the doctors had said that this only happens when the man has an empty stomach. Right? It happens in the morning when he hasn't had a thing. Then he has these kinds of attacks. If that's true, then as long as we know on a regular day for shechita purposes, if we know that he's had a good breakfast and he's okay, we have every reason to believe, with these other safeguards in mind, that we can leave him his job as a shochet. So that's excellent. We've helped him out for part of his job. The second part of his job is being a shliach tzibur, being the chazan on Yomim Noraim. Right? And so having these kinds of attacks would be considered a mum haposel b'kohanim. That was what the questioner had said. It is a blemish that a kohen could not serve in the Beit HaMikdash. If you knew of a kohen who had this problem, he would not be allowed to serve in the Beit HaMikdash in the temple because it's a mum. And there are all sorts of mumin. It's not our topic today, but there are all sorts of mumin. There are all sorts of physical differences, I think is the best way to say it. The Torah says somebody can't serve in the Beit HaMikdash. People today, I've heard, take it as sort of an attack on disability, but as we'll see in a second, the Chatam Sofer, many, many of these mumin, many, many of these physical differences have nothing to do with disability, and yet are considered mumin. So it's a whole different topic, and I think the answer lies in something else about the Beit HaMikdash that's not our time to talk about. But in our case, Chatam Sofer rejects the comparison. He says, Ahuvi, my beloved, v'chichol ha-mumin ha-postim b'avodah nifsal b'shatz, we're going to not allow a chazan who has any of the blemishes that any of, I'm sorry, it's not the greatest word, any of the physical differences that the Torah says me and a person can't serve in the Beit HaMikdash. If that's true, a left-handed chazan can't be a chazan, because a left-handed person, and I am left-handed, so as I record this, I make it clear that I don't think of it as a blemish. It is certainly a physical difference, but it's not a blemish. So that's why I think the word mum is sometimes mistranslated as a blemish. So, but the Chatam Sofer is pointing out, we never heard such a thing that a left-handed person can't be a chazan. That comparison, he says, you're not sure why this person made it. So it's true, Meshivut Yaakov, a very respected meshiv from 100 to 150 years before the Chatam Sofer, had said that we should passel a shatz, a chazan, who was allowed to marry a second wife. So the background to this is that from the time of, from early on, in Ashkenazic Jewry, there's something called Cherem Rabbeinu Gershom. I think academics think it wasn't really Rabbeinu Gershom, but from early on, from around the turn of the millennium in the non-Jewish calendar, from somewhere in the early 11th century, it became well accepted that Ashkenazic men did not marry two women, just like women can't marry two men. problem became, let's say a woman, unfortunately and sadly, went out of her right mind, so she cannot accept a get, right? As I said before, a man who's not his right mind can't give a get, a woman who's not right mind can't accept a get. So you can have a man who's doesn't have a wife, basically, because she's out of her right mind. By out of her right mind, we don't mean today, what we would say today, like she's depressed and she's not the best wife in the world. In those days, another mind could be somebody who couldn't live with her husband, had to be institutionalized, and had fits and whatever it is, and she's really just not part of the marriage. So this is a problem whenever it happens, either side, when either spouse would have that problem, it's a big problem. But in our case, in this case, for men, one of the ways out was they could find a way to allow the man to circumvent that Cheirin Bein Gershom and marry another wife, right? You'd have a Heter Me'Rabanim, controversial today because it seems an imbalance between how men and women deal with problems in their lives. Not our topic in this tshuva, but it was well accepted. Could have a man whose wife, sadly, went out of her right mind. He was allowed to marry another woman. Shmuel Yaakov says such a man should not serve as a chazan for the Yabib Noraim because a Kohen Gadol, the high priest, wasn't able to do the service if he had service in the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippurim, on Yom Kippur, if he had two wives, because the Torah speaks about being mechaper, atoning for his beito, his family, and the Gemara to the Tamin, beito velo shtei batim. He has one house, meaning one wife, and not two. And so the Shvut Yaakov had held, that would be true of a shatz, of a chazan. That seems to me that what the Shvut Yaakov was saying was the function of the chazan on Yom Kippur that we use today is very similar to the function of the Kohen Gadol back then, especially since the chazan for Musaf is the one who recites the Avodah, who reads out the piyut, the liturgical poem that reminds us of the service of the Beit HaMikdash, and we often say in Nishalma Parim Sifateinu that our words should fill in for our missing sacrifices. So I think that's what Shmuel Yaakov meant. He meant that on Rosh Hashanah Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, the Shliach Tzibur really functions very much like a Kohen Gadol. The Chasam Sofer is not buying it. Chasam Sofer says, "Mechilat kvodo dvarav einan nishma'in li." Right? I don't hear it. Since when is a shatz a Kohen Gadol? Right? So then once he's rejected this, and it's not a simple thing to reject an earlier tshuva by a very important Rav, he says, but I want to mention something good I found in that tshuva. In that tshuva, he quotes a tshuva Sarashpa, that if a member of the Sanhedrin became a Zaken Muflag or a Saris, became very, very old, the definition of that would have to be specific to a certain time, but let's say he was over, I don't know, I think 80 might be Zaken Muflag. If he was over that age, or a Saris, or became unable to function in normal physical marital relations with his wife, you take him off of the Sanhedrin. And we don't say that just because he was okay and good when he was appointed to the position, we don't take him down. So there, the Chazal says, I think he's right, because the Zaken and the Saris, the problem is they're not mirachamim. They don't have compassion. That's our worry. Because of what's gone wrong in their lives, they no longer, or because of what's going on in their lives, let's say it's wrong. But let's say when somebody's gotten very, very old, the worry is that their old age has been less sort of concerned about the world, because it's sort of all removed from them, and then they just see things more black and white, more than they should. So I think that's an interesting comment to think about today, because it struck me today several times that people, once they get beyond a certain age, sometimes lose some of their judiciousness. Not everybody, but many of them do, and that maybe there is something to that, even though we live longer than we used to, or it seems like we live longer than we used to. There is something to be said that beyond a certain age, it seems to me that I often notice with people, even when they're fully in their right, in their faculties, it's not a question of they're, you know, losing it, they're fully who they are, but their temperament sometimes changes when they get to a certain, beyond a certain age, and that might be an issue to think about and a concern. In any case, Chasam Sofer says, yeah, and we would take these people out of their position. And that, he thinks, would be true for a chazan as well. That just because somebody was appointed when they were fully capable of being a chazan, if something came along that would make them invalid as a chazan, then we would take them down. But the question of being a nikbah, the question of having these fits, these attacks, so when he's fine, he's fine. And not only that, he knows that in non-Jewish courts, you have people like this who have this illness, and as long as they're well, they serve in the king's court. So if the king court, you know, in a non-Jewish world is going to accept it, he sees no reason why that shouldn't be true here. Problem is, in our case, if we don't have any clue as to when these attacks might come and no warning signs of when the attacks may come, so that's going to be a problem, because to have somebody have a fit like this while in the court, that obviously is a problem. So in our case, this chazan, the doctors have said it's only when he's not feeling well. It's only when he's not had breakfast, not eaten. So therefore, chazan zomer says, on Rosh Hashanah, it's easy. Before he goes to shul, let him eat something. Then he throws in, just for us to think about in our times, he says, before he goes to shul, which is kodem or hayom, which is before the day brightens, meaning they used to daven Rosh Hashanah so early, it wasn't daytime yet when he was going to shul. And that's better because it explains why he might be allowed to eat, because the whole issue of you shouldn't eat before davening only happens once davening is possible. But since he's already going to shul before davening is really possible, like shachar is really possible, that his eating is not at that right time, is not at the wrong time, so he can eat. So if he eats, then we can be fairly confident they won't have these attacks. And he says, and if eating a little bit isn't enough, then it's on me, the Chatzim Sofer says, on me he can make kiddush on wine after tefillat haShachar. So he won't daven shachar, still daven musaf. So if he, after shacharis, he has kiddush on wine and food before the tekiyos to biyushav, as many shuls do today if their shacharis take a very long time. So he says, that I allow it. And it's Karov Hashem Lishvurei Leib. And we can hope and pray that Hashem will be even closer to his prayers, because this is a man whose heart is broken in him, because he knows the danger of, he's got poor people in his house and he's got illness in his house. And so this would be a great chazan, and we can have the hope that Hashem will listen to his tefillah as well, and that will be a great representative of the community to bring Ksiva Chasima Tova. But in Yom Kippur, he says, he can't do it, because there's no way to allow him to eat in the morning of Yom Kippur. So he says, instead of davening Musaf on Yom Kippur, let him daven Kol Nidre. Let him switch jobs to Kol Nidre. Somebody else will daven Musaf, which is Kol Nidre. Now, I was wondering if maybe he could also daven Ne'ilah, because maybe by that time of the day, if he hasn't had an attack, he's not going to have an attack. But the Chasim Sofer doesn't mention it, but he says, let him daven Kol Nidre, because that'll be, after he's eaten, won't be a problem. And then he says, on Yom Kippur itself, he does think maybe he should daven in a side room. Because, so it's an interesting question in terms of when we're sensitive to other people's needs. Here you have other people who might be bothered if he has an attack. I can easily imagine somebody today saying, well, that's their problem. It's not my problem I have an attack. I just have these attacks. So the Chasam says, no, he thinks that sensitivity to other people's sensitivity is in place, and therefore he should daven in a side room in the course of Yom Kippur, and we can hope that he'll eventually get a full refuah shleima, blah, 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 meaning, and all the brachot that we end these kinds of letters with. And that is the Chasam Sofer's a response to this man with a leptic thick on the 11th of Elul of 1828. Very, very briefly, let me share another Chasam Sofer, Kovetz Tshuvot Memvav, from his collection, a collection of Tshuvot, a separate collection of Tshuvot, chapter 46, which he wrote Ke'or Boker, like early in the morning on the 11th of Elul of Tuf Kuf Tzadi Zayin, 9 years later, 1837. He got a letter from Yerushalayim about poor people. So one thing is, he says, before one can collect with the poor of the city, one's generally supposed to be there for a year, and sometimes we say for 30 days, if they've established residence there. He says that the whole idea that we give to poor from our city before poor from other cities, right? The poor of your city come first. By city, it means those who live there. It doesn't mean they were born there. So let's say somebody is born in a certain city and they move away, and then other people move into that city and unfortunately are poor. Those poor people living in this city is what it means. Means the people who live among you are the ones you have to direct your stucco dollars towards first, and only once they're taken care of to some sufficient extent can you then to other people. The Gemara also had spoken about, or Halach had already spoken about, that Aniyei Eretz Yisrael are Kodmin. That there's a priority to the poor of the land of Israel. The Chasam Sofer thinks that only once one is taking care of the poor of one's own city, meaning that Aniyei Eretz Yisrael take priority not over one's own city, but over poor of other cities outside of Israel. But he says also that doesn't depend on whether they're born in my city or not. It's just people who are in Eretz Yisrael are the Aniyim. And then he says, but he thinks it's the poor people who have always lived in Eretz Israel, or they moved there when they were wealthy and now have become poor. But poor people who move to Israel, he thinks, don't get any of that priority, because he says, first of all, because why should they have the right to take money from poor of others? Let's say somebody lives in Buffalo and they're taking care of the poor of Buffalo, and then somebody, a poor guy from Cleveland, comes for help, and the guy from Eretz Yisrael comes for help. Why should the guy from Eretz Yisrael who moved to Eretz Yisrael poor have priority over the Cleveland guy just because he moved to Eretz Yisrael? It would be like, he says, let's say I have somebody who's poor, they need clothing, and I have somebody else who's poor, wants to, their poverty is they want to do some mitzvah that they can't do right now. So which one should we deal with first? So the Chassam Sofer says, it's obvious we would have to give the person food before we make sure that they can do with the mitzvahs. So people who are living in Cleveland, the only thing that the guy who's living in Israel has over him, he says, I want to fulfill the mitzvah of Yeshiva Israel. So why should a poor person have the right to say, on your back, of your tzedakah dollars, of the Cleveland people's tzedakah dollars that I'm going to be competing with, or the Los Angeles, or whatever, all the other poor of the world, on their backs, I'm going to take extra tzedakah dollars. More than that, he says, this poor person will also be taking from the existing poor of Eretz Yisrael, because there's only a certain amount of money that's coming to Eretz Yisrael for the poor people, and he's diluting it by taking a share of that as well, and therefore he doesn't think that's acceptable. And he says, "Lo yachlok ela hamitakesh." You have to be stubborn to try to disagree with this. Obviously, this is the way it should be. So the only poor people who count as the poor of Eretz Yisrael for these purposes are the poor who have always lived in Eretz Yisrael. So those are, in very great brief, one tshuva about the poor of Eretz Yisrael as opposed to the poor of elsewhere. But fundamentally, the Chassam Sofer's ideas about how to help an epileptic shochet, or a person who has various kinds of attacks, continue his job as a shochet and a chazan so that he can be able to support his family. And that is a tshuva a day for the 11th of Elul. Have a great day.